Charles, for anybody who may not have seen some of our previous episodes, could you talk a little bit about your mythology of progress and the concept of anti-progress, and then relate that to your newest book that I want to get into today, which is Ultra-Processed Life, and how this is affecting everybody?
Yeah, Adam, that's a great introduction to the idea that we've been discussing for a number of programs now, which is this idea of anti-progress, which is the idea that what's presented to us as progress, like endless technological innovation and novel products and services and so on, that they're actually detrimental to us and to the planet, and that they do not qualify as progress. They are actually the opposite of progress. And I, in the mythology of progress, what I was trying to accomplish was to delineate the sources of anti-progress, how progress that was obviously beneficial to the common good in the 19th century, such as clean water, and, you know, later in the 20th century, the interstate highway system and so on, rural electrification. There were many advances that quite obviously were progress in the sense of serving the interests of the greater good or the common good. Everybody benefited from these. And what's happened since those advances is progress has been transformed into anti-progress. So with the ultra-processed life, that's my new book, and what I'm describing there is that our experience of anti-progress, where the mythology book was talking about the side of high-end, high-level, large historical forces, roots or sources of anti-progress, the ultra-processed life book examines how we experience this in our everyday life. And so it is about anti-progress, but it's about the way that, as you said before we started recording, that everything is ultra-processed now. And we go, well, what does that mean? And so we go, well, one way of understanding what ultra-processed means is it's exploiting our hard wiring, you know, that we're wired to seek out novelty and convenience, right? Those are like highly valued in a hunter-gatherer society, which is where we spent, you know, 99% of humanity's existence from around, you know, 160,000 years ago to 300,000 years ago. You know, and then up to like the last, say, 12,000 years, which when we transitioned to agriculture, we were all hunter-gatherers. And so seeking out windfalls, novelty, and having the social status within our own little group, our tribe, all those things were meaningful to hunter-gatherers. So that all that hard wiring has now been turned against us in terms of presenting us with addictive products and services that are actually detrimental to our mental and physical health.
I feel like there would be a lot of people that hear that and go, okay, yeah, I get it, right? Processed food, processed stuff, you know, me staring at my phone all the time, except for listening to the content from both of us. You know, outside of that, you know, we're, you know, having this ultra-processed life. But some people say, well, it's worked out though, you know? So the question I would ask you is, in what way do we know that this is really that bad for us? And is it, are we just in a, is it just in between, like, because it's been part of a cycle, are we going to come out of this and be like, okay, we just need to process a little more and we'll find our way out of it? Or do you look at this as a failure that has to be completely corrected and go a different direction?
Yeah, that's a good context for what I mean by ultra-processed life. And so again, we have to refer back to examples of legitimate progress to understand the nature of anti-progress now. So the idea at the beginning of, say, the Industrial Revolution in the 19th century was we were going to use this new hydrocarbon fuels, right? Coal and then oil and then natural gas, to industrialize the planet, essentially. And we were going to turn out products that were going to make our life better on a mass scale. And then because they were mass produced and they would be affordable to virtually everybody, or at least a significant percentage of the human population. So the idea, that was the idea of progress. And then what's happened, though, is everybody has everything in the developed world, right? Everybody's got everything, the car, the fridge, everything's already been made and owned. And so how do you make more profit next quarter? Well, that's the problem. And so the solution has been to sell stuff that's designed to fail. So we have to buy a new one, or it's like fast fashion. It's outdated and obsolete within a few weeks or months, so that, you know, where you're going from being hip and haute couture to like, oh, you're out of it, man. That's so. And then the net result of this kind of lifestyle is, on a planetary scale, there's like, I just saw a statistic. There's something like there'll be 140 million tons of discarded fabrics, i.e. fast fashion, in a few years. And so, like, nobody knows what to do with all the waste that comes from fast fashion, never mind all the other packaging and planned obsolescence. And so we're also, you know, experiencing the way that it's different, the way that anti-progress is being sold, is that you can't really sell it on being beneficial, because it's not. So what it's being sold to us as what's new, right? Like, you got to get the new phone because it has three cameras instead of only two, you know? And so it's not actually benefiting us in any, except in the most marginal possible way. And so what they're doing is they're actually using our psychological insecurities. In other words, the ultra-processed life context is you don't have a real foundation for your internal selfhood, or, you know, your sense of self-worth or your identity. It's all now based on consumption. Like, what do you own? What are you wearing? What are you going to buy tomorrow? And so this is quite different than a pre-industrial kind of society, where your identity was formed by your social ties, you know, your family status, your work, you know. And even now, we can delineate a very interesting difference between the working class identity and the middle class or bourgeois sense of self and identity. Because I've worked in construction for 50 plus years, I'm kind of familiar with the working class. And in other words, people who do the actual work that keeps society functioning, they're not staring at a screen, they're actually lifting pipes and stuff like that. And you also worked in that environment. And so in that job and in that milieu, your identity is your work. You don't really, and if somebody comes in and buys, like, you know, some like high-end truck or something, yeah, we're going to give the guy some grief for it, right? Like, if somebody's going to be like social climbing by buying something, we're going to give them grief. We're not going to say, oh, you're so wonderful now because you bought a high-end truck. It's more like, what an idiot. You paid that for that stupid, useless truck, you know? I mean, and so... But that's not the ultra-processed life perspective. In the ultra-processed life, we're all worthless except for what we buy and what we own and what we wear, etc. So, you know, and part of this is a result of work has become ultra-processed. So we have a lot of BS work. And that's David Graeber's term. He wrote a book about BS work, in which it's work that we all know is sort of meaningless and it doesn't really have a purpose. And so it's not something we can build our identity and self-worth on, because we know it's worthless. Everybody else knows it's worthless. And so how am I supposed to feel good about this as the foundation of my identity? Where compared to like real work, then you actually have an identity. So a lot of ultra-processed life is aimed at stoking our insecurities. In other words, like, using our insecurities as a mechanism to sell us something. And so I just to kind of end this point, the interesting thing about ultra-processed life is how it exploits all of our built-in weaknesses in order to profit from those. And in that process, it makes our life actually worse because our mental health is degraded, our physical health is degraded, and we're not happier, actually. We're actually more anxious, more insecure, and more unhappy. And yet we're constantly being told, you know, here's another wellness product for you.
Charles, it feels like ultra-processed life also has a massive mindset to it, where we almost feels like where we've given up and given into this, oh, okay, well, things are going to be crap and I'm going to feel like crap every day. And, you know, I'm going to have these things. I'm going to take this medicine. It feels like almost abdication in a way. Like we've just given up in a way on having meaningful lives because so much has kind of been extracted from us, and in anti-progress and other things. And it feels like a person who's almost just reaching for anything pleasure inducing to get through. Right. I've had my own struggles with everything from mental health to bankruptcy to going through things. And I get it. There are some times when you've had a crap day, a crap week, lost a family member, whatever, where you just order that pizza with wings and extra ranch and you just say, because I'm going to feel good. And it's sad. You know it's bad, but it works. So, and I lead that on to say, how do we break out? Like, is this book about breaking out of this cycle? Is it about just more identifying it? Why would somebody who's kind of listening to us, why would you encourage them to get this book, and what will it kind of tell them outside of just identifying that this ultra processed life kind of sucks, which I think a lot of people are coming to, thankfully.
Yeah. I think that's a great topic, Adam. And so I did in fact write the book to identify the disease, if you will, and then provide a diagnosis and then offer some path out of it based on, as you just said, based on my own experience. I mean, you know, if somebody hands me a package of, you know, sugary, sweet, salty, ultra processed snack, I'm going to eat the whole thing. I mean, hey, I'm only a human, right? And that's what's so detrimental about ultra processed life is it kind of sucks us in by activating our dopamine receptors, right? And so which bypass our rational minds. So as you said, I can sit there and go, okay, this is bad for me. You know, I'm going to ruin my appetite for a healthy meal by eating this rubbish. But oh boy, this stuff is incredibly good. You know, it's firing all my dopamine receptors, and my rational mind has no control over it. And so that's the same thing with the cell phones, social media, and so on. And so we read these books, right, about the devastation of teenage mental health with all these digital addictions, right? and we all know that it's really hard to stop scrolling, et cetera, et cetera. So how do we deal with this? Well, again, it's like if we look at it like our status quo system, whatever you want to call it, our socioeconomic, you know, political system, if we consider it diseased, then we have to diagnose it and go, okay, here's why it's so detrimental to our health. Now, how do we get out of it? And so I propose a couple of different ways. One is, of course, it depends on the person, right? In other words, there's no one size fits all. But some people find that going cold turkey works. They just don't buy any ultra processed food anymore, and they shut down their social media accounts. Some people just cancel their mobile phone, right? And so that kind of cold turkey approach returns us to the real world. And there's going to be a withdrawal stage because it is an addiction, right? And so there's a period of transition, which can be painful if you withdraw from this addictive digital realm of addictive food and so on. For other people, that's not going to work, right? It's too extreme. So I propose using the Pareto principle as kind of a guideline. And that's kind of what I use for my own diet, which is you know, if you can get 80% real food and then, you know, leave the 20% for, you know, the whatever else you don't want to deny yourself some, you know, treat or whatever, that's going to make real progress in your life. I mean, if 80% of your diet is real food, but it's like totally unprocessed, it's made from scratch, then your health is going to definitely improve, right? And if you go out and you walk a half hour a day religiously, that half hour is going to start paying benefits because it's going to collect about 80% of all the benefits from exercise. You can walk an hour and a half, but that's only going to get you another 15%, right? I mean, it's the first half hour, 35 minutes that really matters. So using that approach, we're kind of leveraging our way out of ultra processed life. So like, say for me, I don't think it works. I can't really, because my business is online, I can't just say I'm going to abandon the digital realm entirely. But I can say, okay, I'm going to spend 5 minutes on social media, check on a few friends' accounts, then click done. And so everybody's going to have to find their own path, but that's what it's going to take, is to recognize that we're being sold what's essentially poison that's addictive. And it's destructive to us individually and to our community and to our family and people we care about. So to withdraw from that is the only way out. You're not going to get a reform bill through Congress that's going to end ultra-processed life. And so another aspect of it is to take control of as much of your life as you can, because ultra-processed life is, as you said before we started recording, it's all about consumption. Like, there's always a consumption solution. So if you're sick, unhappy, and anxiety-ridden, well, we have a wellness clinic here for you. We have some supplements. We've got some psychotherapy. We've got some meds. And in other words, it's always going to sell you something else. And so the solution is to realize that's just part of ultra-processed life. And so you actually want to take back control. Instead of just being a consumer, you want to be a producer and a controller of your own life. So if your work is unfulfilling, then you go ahead and grasp the nettle and say, how am I going to transition to a life where I get to work at something I care about and that's going to provide me a positive identity so I don't care what I wear and what I buy and what people think of me, you know, because I already know I'm good. I'm doing useful work. And so I don't really care whether I'm getting likes or hearts or anything else.
So for someone who has read through this book and they start the, you know, let's just call it the deprocessing part of their life, right? Moving from the ultra processed life that they have into some kind of deprocessing. What is your book about? Giving them kind of showing them the way out? Is it more of what would you classify this as? Would you conclude is this like a self-help thing? Is it more of a education? Is it more of a, you know, a romantic? How would you say to them, hey, when you read my book, this is what you're going to get? I know we've gone over a bunch of different things here and I have some other questions for you, but I'm generally interested as someone who this is my type of book, because they fall into different categories. How would you specifically define it as what they're going to gain from it? What kind of book is it, if that makes sense?
Yeah, and that's an interesting question, Adam, because on Amazon, you know, as if you publish your own book like this, then, you know, you're given these choices of how mm-hmm. What category. And so you can say, well, this is a social science book, mm-hmm. and or, as you say, it's also a self-help book. And then I think I was really tempted to include it as a philosophy book, because it's actually a book that starts out by saying, okay, let's just step back and let's just look at our own lives through the lens of ultra processed life. And then to ask yourself, is this really how I want to live? Am I really benefiting from kind of being in the herd of consuming ultra processed life? Or am I really not happy and it's not beneficial to me? In which case, then I've got to find a path out. And then the book transitions into a self-help book, because I myself have witnessed, you know, the power of ultra-processed life and being addictive and destructive. And as you say, it's self-reinforcing. you know, you live a self, an ultra processed life, you get stressed out. And so then you want comfort, you want relief, you want an escape. And so then you consume more ultra processed stuff. And which then becomes even more addictive, right? Because you're caught up in this sort of like loop. And so it's like, but I think the idea here is, if we step back and looking at ourselves, we go, if once you understand how it works and how, you know, our built-in kind of genetic propensities are being exploited for somebody else's profit, but to our own detriment, you go, you know what? I don't want to live like that anymore. So what am I going to do? And so then it becomes a self-help book, because it's all like, well, here's an approach that you can use and you can experiment, you know, try it, you know, because you want to live a good life, right? And there's an irony in the whole thing with ultra processed life, because all you read about now is wellness and happiness, right? Are you happy? The happiest world, the happiest countries in the world. And here's wellness and this and that. And it's all like, well, if we were really well and happy, then why would we need these enormous industries selling us all this stuff? And so that's the irony, is if we were really as happy and fulfilled and this was really progress, then why would we need like multi-billion dollar industries selling us anti-anxiety meds, anti-depression meds, supplements, you know, wellness clinics, et cetera, et cetera. So the question is so basically my answer is all those things are within your own hands. You're not going to be able to fix your life with a product or service. They may be beneficial in some small way, but the bottom line is we have to take control of our own lives. And that's what ultra processed life is trying to keep us from doing. Because to kind of summarize the book, there's very little profit in a raw carrot. There's nothing you can do to make a raw carrot immensely profitable, right? But if you take an ultra-processed digital service or an ultra-processed snack, then you can make that enormously profitable. And so the kind of pernicious incentive in our system as it is everybody's going to try to sell you an ultra-processed product or service because that's where the money is. No one's going to try to serve you or sell you, you know, whole food, you know, unprocessed food, because there's no profit in there, right? And so we've trapped ourselves in a system where kind of trading our health for profit is now the core of the economy.
I feel like this video should be sponsored by Wellness Industries, whose signature product is self-actualization in a bottle, right? Because it feels like what the system, right? Because it feels like what the system wants to sell you. And the only reason you need that is because you're stuck in this ultra processed life, the kind of a doom loop, right? Everybody's been there where you feel like crap because you have this job that you're just not happy with, and you eat some food that makes you feel like crap. And so you don't go out, you don't go do anything because you feel like crap. And then you end up scrolling on your phone, and then you really feel like crap. And it is one of those things where the whole time, you know, you're doing something that's out of your best interest. But like you said, it's addictive, and it just kind of, because you feel like crap and you don't want to do anything, so you eat more of the crap because you're like, well, I already feel like crap. What the heck? At least I'll feel good for a minute, right? And it reminds me of a story that I used to be told when I was younger, and it's like about the dog who's laying on a plank with nails, and they'd be like, and he'd be yelping. And the person's like, oh, he's laying on a plank with nails. He's like, why doesn't he move? Because it doesn't hurt bad enough yet. Right. And I always love that, because it is, because when you really think about it, you go, do we really make meaningful change most of the time without it finally getting bad enough? How many people get health scares and they finally make changes? How many people do this? So when it comes to this, you know, that kind of UPL or ultra processed life, how do you think this story ends? Right. Your thing is about people getting self-reliant. You have another great book on self-reliance. You have, you know, Mythology of Progress talks all about anti-progress. You have all these great things, and I know you get a lot of systems level, and this is much more in the individual. And as people start to take, say, personal responsibility, or we start to just say, hey, I'm done with this. I'm tired of feeling that crap. You know, I'm mad as hell and can't take it anymore. As more of those moments happen, do you believe this is going to reach a crescendo and then people, and then the system is going to change because the incentives will change? Or do you think it's going to take, you know, a tireless minority to really force big changes where we like force the system to go in a different direction? What's your systems level view on this? Especially because, you know, this channel is about young people, and we're, I would say the most young people, when I talk to them, they know process stuff is bad, right? It's not like a thing anymore. They know the processed things are bad. You know, they don't want this in their food or this and yeah. And so where do you see this going, or do you think it's already moving in that direction, or is it going to be a slog at best?
Yeah, that's, I'm glad you brought that topic up, Adam. And again, I refer to the Pareto principle, which is the 80-20 rule, and it can be broken down into the 4-64 rule. And so the idea with this kind of systems level change is when some movement, social movement or political, reaches about 4% of the population, and it sort of triggers a broadening of whatever was once just really fringe and really on the margins, that 4% encourages it to expand to 20%. And then once it hits 20%, then it starts moving towards 80%. And so that's kind of an example of this is the adoption of the internet, you know, back in the 1990s. It started out with, you know, really slow modems and all that stuff. And only a handful of people were on like message boards like The Well and so on. And it was kind of a fringe activity of techies and so on. And then when it hit 4%, then it quickly expanded to 20%. And then once speeds and technology caught up, then bang, pretty soon 80% of the population was on the internet. So there's something like that, that I don't think we're going to find a political way to solve it. I don't think we're going to get a political movement to reform it. And so it's just going to be people taking control of their own lives. And I think we're already seeing that in the way that, say, school districts are banning having cell phones on during class. We're seeing states or local governments limiting social media membership to the age 16 and older. And that kind of sort of grassroots response to ultra-processed, addictive digital products. And it's also individually, like one of my readers sent me a note that he'd heard that in Montana, there's some people who they've even cut their landline. They have no cell phone, no digital, no internet, nothing. If you want the guy to come and fix, you know, your plumbing, you drive to his house and you knock on the door and you go, okay, that's pretty extreme. But that's kind of speaking to the range of responses that I mentioned, right? Like there's a range that's going to work, you know, for different people in different places. But I think what's going to happen is people are going to become more and more aware that they're going to have to take control of their own lives, and that playing around with things that are designed to be addictive is a no-win situation. You're not going to beat the big tech companies. You know, they've got tens of thousands of people making huge sums of money to make the products more addictive every day. So you're not going to beat them. You're not going to be able to do it unless you have a goal and the idea that you really have to limit your exposure to these addictive things, you know, as the only way to escape them, because they're designed to exploit our hardwiring. So I think the movement will gather force, and I'm hopeful that the young, like Gen Z, will embrace this. And of course, corporate America is then going to start responding with, oh, healthier ultra-processed food. And of course, we have to anticipate that they're just going to try to sell us more ultra-processed junk under the label of, oh, this is a healthier alternative. And so there really is no substitute for any of this stuff. In other words, that's one of the points I'm trying to make in the book, is there's either authentic life, like the real world that you live in, or it's inauthentic. It's staring at a screen. It's looking at a menu, because all of that technology leads us to believe that it's a summary of the real world. You know, like, oh, well, this is like all there is, because it's, here's my menu on my screen. And it's all like, no, it left out all of authentic life. It's only giving you menus of ultra processed life. And so the authentic world is much more demanding. You know, there's convenience is not so much. Novelty, well, you might have to do boring stuff. But you're living in the real world, and that's the source of human fulfillment and happiness. And so, you know, if you're going to only eat real food, then it's pretty easy. You don't buy anything that's packaged, anything that has more than two ingredients, the product and maybe some salt. Then you don't buy it. Well, and the same thing with work. You know, if you're going to do real work, then you're going to get satisfaction from real work that you're not going to get from staring at a screen. So, and I stare at a screen a lot, but I get tired of it, because I know there's something inauthentic about any screen, really.
As somebody who grew up in front of a screen and has had relationships and stuff through them and has built friends and is a gamer and runs a business and heck is doing an internet podcast, like I can sit back and hear it and be like, yep, I know that I've changed the way I do things. And I do feel like we've left the infant stage of the internet, where it was seen as just everything was amazing, right? I think we're almost fully out of that, where now it's maturing, you know, where people look at it and go, this is a tool for good or bad, right? I think we've reached that point, which I think is good. And I think ultra processed life goes through that. I think in the food complex and some other things, I think we've reached like the, I don't know, the terrible midlife crisis, I hope, where we've just seen how terrible we can go with things, with like, how crappy can we make this and short term can we be? And I hope that people in general could just be like, we're all pretty much done with this, because it is kind of amazing. And you've talked about this before with fashion trends and hairstyles and all kinds of other things. They can very quickly come and be there for a while, and then they can be gone. People can just decide, yeah, we're done with this. And then it's just bell bottoms are in the trash. It's over. Disco is done. Put it away. Unfortunately, some people will hold on to it and love it. But I very much hope that people are able to review ultra processed life. And I encourage them. I personally have talked with Charles, and I think this fits very well in with the self-reliance book that you have, in the writings you've done about, you know, the landfill economy, with the mythology of progress, talking about how anti-progress is happening. And ultra processed life is just like what we experience, and what I, as I read through it, have experienced as somebody who ate a lot of gummy bears playing video games and drinking soda, and then being like, going to bed and be like, why do I feel like crap? Well, why do you think you feel like crap? You know, 10 hours of World of Warcraft and gummy bears and soda is probably not how you were meant to live, right? It's about as far away from the existence I was created for. But I appreciate you going over with that. And I hope, in one of the main things I hope from this is that in Montana, I'd be very happy to see like pigeon postmasters come back, because I always thought that was a really cool job. So if people are getting rid of landlines, I'll be all up for training pigeons to be carrier pigeons and do messages. But that would be more, but the sad part for many of us, that would be a more authentic, you know, life than what we have. What we have, this processed version. It's just like a life that's been hollowed out for profit. And look, you don't have to be an anti-capitalist or full-blown commie to look at it and just go, you could be all for profits and go, I don't think we need to literally kill our society or literally follow in the books that were like, hey, we're entertaining ourselves to death. And people are like, cool, let's go with that. It's like when people joke about 1984 wasn't a manual. Sometimes I think some of these books about how we're going to, like, you know, titillate ourselves to death, I feel like some people took this to heart. And I agree with you. I agree with you on how we're going to have to do this at a self level, right? People like us are going to have to make the change that, hey, even though I work online, I don't have to drink corn syrup filled soda, and I don't have to eat gummy bears. And I know I'm going to feel like crap, but I'm going to go exercise. And you know what? I'm going to go walk, and I'm not just going to go play video games for 6 hours tonight, even though I'm love video games, not knocking them, but I can go have dinner with my friends in person and not be on my phone the whole time, right? I believe this is coming. I'm super biased. I want it to happen. So maybe other people are like, no, we're heading the other direction. But I see what I hope is the beginnings of us rejecting the ultra processed life. And I hope people read through your book and your other ones and see that. And I'll let you jump in here and kind of any final things you want to do, tell people where to find you or any last words on your book. But I just want to commend you for it, because I got a lot out of it and I wish I had had it much sooner.
Yeah, I think I would summarize it like this, Adam, and as in my own journey to understand ultra-processed life, I think it boils down to this. We all can recognize anti-progress. And so the question is, do I want to live my life as anti-progress, or do I want to make some other choice? Do I, you know, I understand anti-progress is out there, but I don't want to live it. And so that's really what my book is about. And yeah, please find me on Substack at Charles Hugh Smith or oftwominds.com. Thank you, awesome. Adam.